All right. Hello, everyone. I am here with Mukti. So, Mukti, would you like to say hello to them so we can do a sound check on your mic?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show today. It's great to be with you.
Okay. Are you getting an echo?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so. Let me turn it down a little bit. Let's try this again. Go ahead. See how it works now.
I'm glad we'll have this time together as Regina is asking me a few questions, and I'd be so happy to hear from each of you as well.
Okay, you guys can hear Mukti okay then, right? Yes, yes. They all say the echo went away for them. Did it go away for you as well, Mukti?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. All right, then. I think we have the volume set. So as she is saying, you know, I've explained to her that you all can raise your hand and ask questions. And so as she is saying, she is very, very willing for that to happen. So I'll just get started as we usually do, but I will be checking on you all to see if your hands are up, and if so, I'll turn the mic over to you. So, hi, Mukti.
Hello.
It's good to be here with you. I think probably, you know, I have, just like people often do before they interview someone, you know, I've been listening to audios, I watched the Buddha at the Gas Pump interview, that kind of thing, to make sure I knew you a little bit. I know Adya Shanti a little better. In fact, I've read a couple of his books, and I saw him in Boulder one time. I went up to Boulder, Colorado, and saw him. I live in Pueblo, Colorado, so I drove up there and saw him. So I know him a little better. I don't know you quite as well, so I'm really excited to get to know you.
Wonderful.
One of the things that I saw when I was, you know, checking up on you was the words that you have been his student since, I think the date was 1996. And if I remember correctly, you were married to him prior to that. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So what I'm curious about then is kind of what the heck does that mean? I've been his student. Like, when did this turn into a student relationship? What does it mean to be a student of someone, especially someone who also happens to be your partner? If you could just start telling us about that.
Sure. Okay. I'd be happy to. We'll see what comes out. Well, yes, Adi and I had known each other for a few years, and then shortly after we were married, his Zen teacher, who's local to me here in Saratoga, California, she had asked Adi to begin teaching, and she was retiring. I think at the time she was in her 80s. She's still living. But she had asked him to teach, and I was just really trying to be helpful wife in helping him set up a group and make flyers and get started. And I had no intention of becoming more interested in his line of teachings and Buddhism and other flavors of spirituality, because I had my own guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, and where Adi and I really shared a lot of spiritual territory was through meditation, and we had been meditating together, but I hadn't been really involved in his tradition. So it wasn't until I really helped him get this started and began attending his presentations and what later became known as satsangs, that I really found myself incredibly drawn and incredibly interested in, and I really began to perceive him as my teacher, as well as my husband and closest friend and all of those other roles. And as far as what that means to me, being a student, it means many things. You know, I guess it's an attitude that I have toward pretty much all of life, that any person, any situation, any being can be a teacher for me. So it's an attitude that I have internally to see more clearly, to know more deeply, to express more skillfully. And so I'm always continually learning. But in particular, when I say that he is my teacher, it really means to me that I've really digested his teachings in a way that have been incredibly transformative there's a way that I was able to receive them because I had such a, and do have such a deep and incredible respect and trust for him, I honor that, that vantage point of that deep respect and trust, by calling him my teacher. And I think it feels like it's a certain kind of attitude when we perceive someone as our teacher of very deep regard and perhaps being profoundly affected by their teachings.
Now you talked about, oops, there's the echo again. So I'm getting it. You talked about transformation. Can you share a little bit about some of the transformations that you experienced and maybe even if there's, you know, something that brought those about that you're aware of that might be helpful to share, just any stories at all that come to mind around the transformation?
Yes, yes. Well, I think that even though I had studied a path of realization with Paramahansa Yogananda's teachings, I never knew Yogananda when he was living, but had studied his teachings for much of my life because my parents were devotees of his, so I was exposed to his teachings at a young age. But in as much as I had studied realization through his teachings, it wasn't until I listened to Ajahn's teachings that realization became even more real to me. And that was a big transformation in and of itself. I really let in much more deeply the notion that realization is quite possible in one's lifetime. And just letting in that notion was incredibly transformative to me. Because I think at some level, although it wasn't due to Yogananda's teachings, but just somehow in myself, I kind of felt like, you know, maybe realization might be possible in many lifetimes or somewhere in the distant future. But I think in listening to Ajahn, it just really brought that possibility much more home and made it much more relevant for me. So I think that was probably the first big transformation I had. And also just, probably one of the biggest transformations I had in terms of meditation was I'd had a background in meditation, learning many techniques that were helping me focus my mind and attention, whether it be on breathing or mantras or different things. And I didn't really consider myself a great meditator. You know, I just had such an active mind. Even though I had been doing it for a long time, was able to sit relatively still physically. I didn't really feel very still, and Ajahn really revolutionized meditation for me when he suggested that instead of focusing and trying to kind of narrow my awareness on a given object of perception, like a mantra or the breath, that it was possible to open my attention and to listen and sense and see in a much more relaxed and global manner. And he used this image of the thinking mind being like a horse that can feel like it's trapped in a horse stall. And it's not being let out, you know, as it might feel confined to like one's wish to stop thinking, you know. And so he said instead, you know, think about letting the horse out and to roam in this wide open pasture of your awareness. And I did find that incredibly helpful because as I listened to the environment and let my attention kind of give way into this larger field of awareness, I noticed my thinking became much, much, much more quiet because my mind, instead of tracking thought, began to just have a much more receptive attention.
Yeah.
And so that was very revolutionary for me and it was a big transformation in my practice. As far as probably the most relevant answer to your question about transformations for me, that was a real shift in my sense of reality and my sense of myself, and that came actually on the heels of becoming much more skillful and able to rest in a sense of awareness that gave me a sense of my nature that was not defined by dualistic thought patterns or what sometimes is called ego identity, and gave me a much greater sense of my nature as awareness through that global listening and meditation instructions from Adya. And on the heels of that, I was working with an inquiry question and dropping that inquiry question into that space or field of awareness as though I were posing that question to spirit or awareness. And the inquiry question I was working with at the time was, it had been this question, what is rest? And I loved that question because my life at the time was exceedingly packed, jam-packed with school and work and internships and helping Adi get his teaching started. But over the course of many months, that question evolved into a different version of the question, which became, what is stillness? And in really asking and posing that question to my being, actually in a very physical, kinesthetic way, like dropping that question into the core of my being and letting it settle in what feels like the depths of a lake of water, and just letting that question just ripple through my being, it really drew my whole human, almost felt like it drew my human consciousness and attention right into the question, just like united with that question that carried into this deep quality of stillness. And then what resulted was on the heels of asking that question as though it were a more interiorized question, my attention spontaneously went to the outer world and became curious about what stillness was in the larger body of life. And that was like one after the other in a given period of meditation. The two ways that the question was working inside and outside. And it just carried my consciousness into a sense of stillness that is present in the midst of all the change and comings and goings of the forms of life that arise in the present moment. And so so my sense of self just really went quiet into that stillness. And then I went to sleep for the night. And I just remained in the exact same position like all night long. It just felt like I entered into this void of stillness. And then in the morning, when I got up, it just really felt like I, as I had taken myself to be, did not get up. And even though I was functioning and moving in the world, and in fact, I was the retreat leader, I just had no awareness of a sense of me or personal self for some hours until somebody started to do full prostrations in front of me. Yeah, they just started like fully prostrating in front of me, and all of a sudden, I think just some sense of self and other like appeared, because the particular dynamic kind of somehow just seemed to feel their sense of otherness or something in that moment, and then was perplexed that they perceived me as something other. And so some functioning that can differentiate that came back online in my being, and I just found it all so hilarious that that such a trick can exist, that out of wholeness can appear differentness. As in a sense, like out of the absolute can appear the relative, and so that was a huge transformation for me that really left me changed fundamentally. Many of the characteristics of who I had been prior and some conditioned patterns returned, but I was fundamentally transformed and different from that point. There was a real sense of eternal nature that presents as us as individuals and as all of life. That sense of that which is never born and never dies.
Well, we have a question in the room. They didn't raise their hand, so I will ask the question. I think it's a question. Maybe you're just writing down what she said, because she said this. She said, Mukti said she asked, what is rest and what is stillness? So you guys are just echoing her, right? Yeah, they're not really asking the question, I don't think. They are basically taking notes in the room, and they're echoing what you're saying, because, of course, when we echo what somebody says, we take it in deeply. So they're asking what is rest and what is stillness, but I think they're just listening to you is what they're doing. So
just to say a little bit more about that, if other people listening today have heard me before, you may have heard me speak about this. One of the most valuable pointers I had from Adya for self-inquiry was to take a question of import and pretend like I was imbibing it in a smooth stone, and then to imagine my local mind and body and the field of awareness that is can be known as our spirit self, you could say, as a lake of being, and then to drop the inquiry question and let it carry into the depths of that lake of being and just reverberate and ripple into that lake of being. And so just to give you, those of you who are echoing or want to echo now, just to get a feel for that, it could be the question, what is stillness, which is the one I ask. It could be many, many questions that are really meant to evoke spirit awareness, consciousness to reveal itself more fully. And so it could be a question like, who am I, or what am I, or any such question, what is peace? And so in just giving you the tone of it, what I did was just drop this pebble as though it were breaking the surface of that lake at the crown of my head and just going deep into my body, like down in front of my spine. What is stillness? And just having that carry my attention and consciousness with the question. And in that type of questioning, there's really just a complete offering of one's self to the question, like in a sense, like just yielding to however the question might carry. And so the question isn't meant to produce an answer in the mind, but it's meant to orient us to a quality of being, you could say.
And I'm the one with the echo now. Is it bothering you? I can ignore it as long.
Yeah, that's fine with me. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, one of the books I mentioned to you that I've read, a couple of Adya's books, and one of them is True Meditation. And in fact, Awakening Together is a church. But it's a church, I don't know what you would call it. It's trans-religious, it transcends religion. It's just a truth. It's just a church where we all support each other in awakening. That's what we do. And we have a minister preparation program. And our meditation course uses his book, True Meditation. And we don't teach the courses, you know, like some people would think. We, each week people contemplate a chapter and practice it, and then they come back and they talk about their experience with it and what they saw as they contemplated. So it's all about contemplating it within. But it's a very small book, and I think people can misunderstand small, thin books, read them too quickly, okay, I'm done with that one, and throw it aside. But what you are expressing, first of all, some of what you're expressing, it's the essence of the book, but some of the things you shared aren't in the book. But, yeah, that type of meditation is very, very helpful, that type of inquiry, and we really appreciate that he put it down on paper so that people have that coaching to help them learn it themselves, since we can't all be married to him and have him as our teacher. It's nice. All right, my next question then. One of the things I did today was I listened to the Buddha at the Gas Pump interview, and a word that comes up, two words that come up in that conversation are awakening and enlightenment. And as you know, those are just words, and people can use them in a lot of different ways. So I thought that I would ask you, just in your way of using those words, what do those words mean?
Okay. you know, it's funny. Like I do get asked this question relatively often, but I'm the kind of person that I don't really bank my responses. It's just like whatever comes in a given moment, and it always kind of makes me laugh because like, oh yeah, how am I going to answer this? You know, even though it's something I've heard so many times. And I think what I mean by that is that awakening is something that really it can't be defined. But I will attempt it, knowing that that's not possible. I think, like you said, there's many different kinds of there's many different ways that people would define it or experience awakening. There are many types of awakenings. Certainly there can be, you know, awakening out of seeking. There can be awakening out of a sense of ego. There can be an awakening of the source or the emptiness of beingness. There can be awakening to oneness. There can be many heart awakenings, heart openings. Many. So probably for each of those, I would need their own definition. But personally, when I think of awakening, I have to say that I kind of refer more directly to my own experience and speak from that experience. So I think of awakening as a as something that is not an awakening that we can do or take credit for or even in a sense make happen, although we can participate in the process, but that awakening is an awakening of that essential beingness that is expressive of all of us and of all of life and of reality, and that is what awakens to know itself through form, through in a human form, and in and as this world of form. So that's how I would think of awakening, as an awakening of consciousness, you could say, into human consciousness or into the manifest realm. Such that spirit can know itself as form, and such that we as a form of life can know ourselves as spirit simultaneously.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And what about enlightenment? Is it synonymous with that, or is enlightenment something different?
You know, often I'll use it synonymously. I could definitely see people using them differently. Sometimes awakening's more referred to that kind of an initial sort of tipping of scales or kind of turn of sense of identity where it shifts from a sense of egoic or personal self to a deep knowledge of of oneself and all of life as spirit. And so I think often awakening is referred to as the dawning of that realization or that blooming of consciousness. And then sometimes enlightenment is referred to as a kind of embodied expression of that may take some degree of time to really express more fully in an individual.
So maybe consistency, right?
Yeah, you can think of it as consistency. That's an interesting question. Yeah, you could think of it as that.
Well, tell me why you're not just saying a wholehearted yes. So what's going on behind that?
Well, you might have heard of the phrase, like always being, always becoming. And so I think when people think of consistent wakefulness or abiding wakefulness, there may be some mental construct around that of a kind of final point. And I think that, where things are then consistent.
I'm done.
Yeah. But I think my sense is that it's the very coming to peace of the continual unfoldment that, in a sense, is the consistency in the midst of the continued deepening or continued embodiment. That it's the very sense of not really referring anymore to a finality point, that when that gets put to rest, there is sort of a feeling of consistency, but it doesn't necessarily reflect in a consistent expression that, let's say, somebody may carry as a concept in their mind.
Right. I understand. Thank you for explaining that.
Yeah.
My next question is still around the word awakening. I think probably the word that I use that sounds synonymous to the word that you use, awakening, is I call it shift. It's a shift from one way of perceiving and being and understanding and experiencing to another. And as you mentioned, there can be many, many shifts. You could call the beginning of the spiritual path an awakening, right? Something that caught my attention and shifted me in a whole new direction. But the experience that you talked about as awakening, that shift is, of course, a very profound shift. So my next question is, what about the ego? And by the ego, I think I'm talking about several things right now. I'm talking about the sense of I am a personal self, as well as the habits and the conditioning and the fears that come along with that. After the awakening that you spoke of, the profound shift, is the ego still there? And if so, how is the ego then experienced?
Well, I can answer that for myself. Okay. You know, different people might answer differently. If we were to just take a working definition, I'm going to use one of Adya's that I think is really helpful and one that I use a lot myself, which is if we think of ego as the movement of grasping and aversion, that it just feels like it's informed by a sense of self, like at the center of experience, that's trying to manage their experience of, usually, you know, so that we have a positive experience. And so, you know, pushing away what we resist and what feels unpleasant and grasping for more for what would feel pleasant. Then if we think of that as ego, I would say that for myself, there was some time, like many, many days, weeks, however long it was, where I didn't really feel that sense of ego or have a sense of self that had a preference about things or, you know, that wanted to, be protected or, or validated or things like that. And then for myself, certain patterns started to return. But it was almost like the house had been torn down, and then like the scaffolding went back up, and you know, like certain framing went back up. But the foundation was just completely different. And so it was experienced more like, the kind of the fundamental architecture or foundation of my being, was known to be, you could say the eternal or spirit. And then like what returned as I experienced it, it was kind of more like, oh wow, look at that. Oh my gosh, like look at these patterns. And it was almost like I was seeing them for the first time, even though that's not exactly true, because they were very familiar and I had experienced those patterns, you know, for much of my life prior. But it was as though I could really see them much more clearly as they return, and sometimes not so clearly. You know, I could sense that they weren't something that ultimately defined me, but I still didn't feel like I could function clearly in the midst of those conditioned patterns. And so, but there was enough kind of conscious intuition and instinct that had come online in that awakening or that larger shift, as you would call it, that I experienced that those conditioned patterns much more differently. And there was an openness of heart, like a wakefulness of heart that was really, willing to even more willing than before to, kind of enfold those patterns of conditioning. And I just intuited that they too, were seeking liberated state. And that was something that I didn't really get before, like in my previous life. It just felt more like those patterns are just stuff I'd rather not, you know, deal with or that I just wasn't even aware of.
Okay, well, what you just said, I've never heard anyone put it anywhere near that way before. Usually when I talk to people, you know, there's lots of similarities, which is wonderful because everybody's having the same experience, so that's the way it should be. But the way you just worded this was very different, so I'd love to zero in on it. You said okay. That when those patterns came back, you saw that they too were seeking a liberated state.
Yes.
Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, okay, so you mentioned ego as, let's say, fear in a little few moments ago. And so an example might be, and there's all different kinds of fear also. But an example might be, trying to think of one that might be more relevant. You might even have a favorite. You know, there's like fear of being misunderstood is one that's popping into my mind, or fear of being unsafe, or, you know, there's lots of them. But basically what I could sense was that a pattern of fear, that especially one that felt familiar, like something that had visited many times before. It could be for me personally, there was a kind of a big thing around fear of being misunderstood or rejected or kind of ousted. And when that would come up, I could see that it felt old, and that it felt like it had kind of been put and in place and locked in place from past very trying or difficult experiences, and so I could feel that it didn't feel true to my current reality, that the pattern felt like it was somehow locked in a prior experience or a prior set of experiences, and just that feeling of it feeling older or locked or not matching the current reality that didn't feel unsafe or didn't feel that the memories were actually playing out in the same way in the current time. helped me see that this pattern was something that was antiquated, you could say, and that was no longer clued into reality as it is. And so I just had to talk to myself, you know, and often the way I would do it was just kind of talk to myself as though I was that person who had the difficult experiences in the past, maybe a young girl or teenager or whatever it was. And I didn't always have access to the exact age or the exact memory, but I would just talk to myself as though there were a part of myself that was younger and had gone through a difficult time, and just comfort that one and kind of listen and see if I could understand or know its worldview more, and then reflect a current worldview to that part of myself and see how it could shift and see more clearly how that pattern of fearfulness or resistance might be kind of like taking up energy, currency or something in a way that wasn't actually serving well-being.
Yes.
And then I could talk to that part of myself and kind of reflect back to them. Hey, like this whole idea that, you know, you're keeping me safe and you're keeping everything okay is actually off the mark, because this pattern of fearfulness is actually perpetuating pain versus bringing about well-being, you know. And so I was able to kind of talk to that pattern and like thank it for all its hard work and, you know, and like just tell it, you know, it's okay. You don't have to keep it on overdrive and, you know, continue with working so hard, because it's not needed now. And more importantly, that energy is really, that currency of energy that's tied up in the fear is really needed, more in present time to express differently.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
So that's a big way I worked with it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful. As you were speaking, I almost had this image of, you know, like, I'm going to call it most of you shifting up, like a light level shifting up, but a few little pieces kind of hanging down there, but they were still linked to you by a light string, and you were helping them up. Yeah, helping them to join you. That's very sweet. Now, what about, how did you experience, whenever you experienced any, I often use the word purification to talk about, you know, the healing or the transforming of those types of energies. So prior to the shift or the awakening, were you already looking at parts, habits that you knew did not serve, conditioning that you did not serve, and was your experience of it different before? How did you work with it before?
Yeah, I would say yes, definitely. It was something I naturally have done my whole life, just been like introspecting. It wasn't something I necessarily learned like working with somebody, or although I was listening to lots of, you know, spiritual talks, especially Yogananda's. I also went to Catholic schooling for my whole life, so I was picking up on lots of ways of relating, and whether that be externally or internally with my own personal self, my own personal experience. So I was doing that really my whole life, and I had just a real hookup for it, and maybe even fascination. So it was just going on daily, you know. And it could just be while I'm, you know, driving, walking down the hall from here to there. It was a lot. I was kind of big on that. So let me just real quickly just correct my video. I'm not sure if you can still hear me. I hope.
I can. I can hear you and see you, but it is starting to get a little shifty.
Okay. Yeah, sorry about that. But how I worked with it before, I know. I'm getting a little long-winded here, excuse me. I think mostly, I can't entirely remember, it's been so long, but I think mostly I would just pray to see things more clearly, and I would realize that there was so much that I couldn't rectify or or come to know or clarify within myself. So I would kind of regularly just have this image of placing that in God's lap and with just a very sincere prayer that I come to know more clearly what's happening in my the way I'm expressing or the way others are expressing, so that I might be more skillful with it.
After the awakening, then you were kind of gathering up the parts that didn't make it and helping them up. It sounds like prior to the awakening, you were handing things up to the awakened part that you weren't already aware of. You know, passing it up.
That will probably be the main broad stroke of the themes of before and after.
What about your ideas of God? How did they change?
Oh, dramatically. I had a really God-centered life before that. Just from probably the day I, you know, came out into the world, because of the family that I was brought up in was really religious, a Christian. And so after the awakening, there was just this real sense just the whole notion of God just didn't compute. I kind of got it, but it's just like the whole way I held it just didn't make sense anymore. But over time, as kind of more sense of my relative self returned, my relationship to the notion of God or the word God, somehow sort of reached a little bit more of a middle ground, because I went from being very God-centered to just sort of feeling like, you know, there's nothing outside of oneself that, you know, it's like the totality is oneself or God. So the whole notion of myself as a subject, praying to God as an object, just went defunct. However, over time, you know, I've come back into situations where prayer is occurring, or prayer like spontaneously happens in me, or devotional acts or things like that, where I can kind of hold both, that there is a sense of myself that doesn't consider God apart from myself at all, as although my individual relative human expression may choose to kind of play out this this offering of my human instrument or my human sense of self to this notion of the totality. In that way, it's almost like came full circle, where almost like both vantage points are totally fine to coexist for me now.
That's wonderful. I understand that perfectly. That's my experience as well. You just described. So maybe hard for some people to understand, but I love devotion, and so sometimes devotion happens. Then at the same time, there's not a sense of another God. So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see. What shall I ask now? Now I've come to a place where I don't have a question. So if you just have something to share, feel free. If not, something will come in a moment.
I'm just checking the time too, because I'd love to have plenty of time for dialogues from anybody who might want to raise their hand.
Well, maybe that's a good time to just put out that invitation. Sometimes they don't put up their hand, but right now I have run dry. I don't have a question. So please, if there's something you'd like to ask Mukti, please put up your hand. I would be very, very happy to turn the mic over and she can hear some other voices.
It could even be a topic. You know, like if you just like me to speak to something in particular, like a territory you find yourself in.
While they're not doing anything, maybe someone will in a moment. But let me ask, one of the things you and I talked about briefly in that moment just before we went live in the room was you asked if I was going to do an interview or if you were going to do satsang. And I said, well, You know, usually we ask questions that we can do anything. I think I'd like to ask, let's say we had done satsang. If I had said, we're going to do satsang, what would that have been?
Yeah. I hadn't had a chance, although often what will happen to me in a given moment is just a topic will come, you know, if I know that a topic is being called for. And I do have a couple of themes of things that I've been speaking about more often lately. So I had a sense that if you were to say there might be a satsang, I thought, oh, maybe one of these themes will come forward. The night before last, I was offering a satsang, and I thought that maybe I was going to speak on a topic I'd spoken on a couple of times this last month called The Phases of Awakening. And when I sat down to speak that night, it just kind of came very clearly that I was going to be talking about realization through a path of union or unity. And so that's in large part what I've been speaking about this weekend. I spoke Friday night, and then yesterday I taught a one-day retreat. And in large part it was about the path of union. But also a big theme I spoke about yesterday was the face of God, you could say, that looks a little bit different than the divine face of grace or of presence. And it's you could call it the face of what is, just the reality of what is. And so I spoke a lot to the value in knowing reality in that way, and how it's quite different than kind of looking for a certain enlightenment or reality that is really has a flavored tone of the divine. So those are some topics I've spoken about lately.
All right. Well, now you're giving me more questions. Yeah, in fact, one person in the room is asking the first question that came up in my mind. So I guess that will be the one. The question was, what is this path of union?
Oh, okay. Yeah. We'll find out. That's probably the best answer. I think for me, you got a flavor of it when I was speaking about how I was working with the question, what is stillness? Mm. And that lake of being, in the sense that there's this really kind of basic rule I started to understand, especially through the way Adya has presented, but also a little bit through my training in Chinese medicine, that wherever our attention goes, energy will follow. And so there's a way that when our attention really joins like an inquiry question, or it could join a sense of the source of a thought or the source of the breath, or sometimes in Zen they call it, you know, the gap. When our attention and our consciousness really merges and joins with things of this nature, there's a way that our sense of personal self or separate self yields to that object of attention. You could call it an object of devotion. Mm. And when our consciousness just really enters that, there's a way that we can have a sense of union with that. And sometimes union can feel very palpable, like a kind of joining. Like some people have experienced like union with a tree, or sometimes they'll be staring at a wall and feel like they are that wall, or unity experiences with one given object of perception. But when the object of perception is something more universal, like let's say source of thought, source of breath, source of sounds you might be listening to in the environment. then it can feel a little bit different than a unity experience with one given object, one given animal or tree or whatever it might be, one given lover. And it can feel more like a joining with a sense of the universal. And but if that in that joining all felt sense of self gives way to that. And then some sense of separate self may return thereafter, or maybe a great sense of personal self will have kind of dissolved in that union.
That's beautiful.
So I hope that answers the question.
It answered it perfectly for me, and it was beautiful. Thank you very much. Yeah, and it looks like in the room, it looks like they understood as well. Another question that came to mind while you were kind of talking about what satsang might look like, it doesn't really have anything to do with what you said, except I think it was the word union that set it off in my mind. One of the interviews I watched with you, you said something about relationship as a part of your awakening practice. I was wondering if you could talk about how a relationship helps to awaken us.
Okay. Well, I think just out of ease, maybe I'll just answer how it did for me, because it's just like a huge topic. But maybe narrow it down a little bit. Well, let me see. Maybe I could make it more universal. I mean, I just really love this one phrase of Yogananda's that I think summarizes it in a very more universal way, which is he says in his ceremony that he would give for marriage when he would marry people. There's this phrase he would always state, which is the purpose of spiritual marriage is to see that the one in me and the one in my husband or wife, and I would update that, you know, in current time or in my partner, is the same one in all of life. And I think that's a great synthesis of how the path of a partnership or, you know, deep friendship can be an arena in which we see the one in ourself and the one in the other as the same one in all of life. But having heard that prior to marrying Adya and been contemplating what spiritual marriage actually is, after I married Adya, I had this experience of watching him have his first interaction with Gangaji, another spiritual teacher here in the Bay Area who largely teaches in this Bay Area. She and Adya were speaking together in a way where I could tell they had a shared perspective or a shared sense of reality that I wasn't privy to. So for me personally, that was like this spark within me, because I had such a deep yearning to know what spiritual marriage was truly and to live that with Adya, that when I saw that, it was interesting. I didn't feel jealous in the slightest. I just recognized it, and I was like, oh, there's something happening with them. There's something that the two of them know that I don't have an awareness of at this point. And in that moment, just quite spontaneous.
So one moment we're starting.
Matter-of-factly. This knowing came.
We're starting to lose sound just a little bit.
You're stuck?
No, you're not stuck, but yes, the sound is starting to go out. I'm wondering if there's something we can do. I'm going to try turning off my video and just leaving you, and that way maybe the sound will be better. If it doesn't work, I'll come back, okay?
Yeah, I could also put on my headset.
Okay. I think it's more Skype than...
More Skype?
Okay. Yeah, I think it's more Skype. I'm just going to try turning off my video, and maybe that will free up some bandwidth.
Sure.
All right, let's see what happens. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, so just quite matter-of-factly, this thought rose to mind, which was... I must come to know this perspective. And it wasn't like a personal thought. Sorry, I'm just the picture. I'm just plugging in my microphone in case we need it.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. In fact, the sound did get better when I turned off my video, so I'm gonna leave it that way because I'd rather hear you.
Okay, we'll try both just in case. So it was just very fascinating looking back that it didn't feel like a personal agenda that, you know, like I must come to know that. It was more just like a fact, like I will come to know this perspective. And it was just like something served up on a silver platter. Like I must come to know this, like with the flavor of I will come to know this, all built into one thought. And so that was just this huge energizing force in my system from there on that it just really turned up the heat on my interest in coming to know who and what we are.
Yeah, I understand. And that's wonderful that, you know, that it naturally occurred in you that instead of jealousy, it just heated up the inner fire that wanted to awaken. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, I was fortunate, yeah.
My next question, I feel a little funny asking it because it sounds very personal, and if you don't want to answer, you don't have to, but I'm curious because so many people live in relationship, and as you know, a relationship can be extremely difficult. So my question is, first of all, I won't assume there have been tense times. I will ask, have there been tense times in your relationship with Adya? And then if so, you know, what is an enlightened way or of experiencing, I don't mean in, you know, as an enlightened person, but an enlightened way of experiencing, tense times, conflict that might be helpful to someone else to hear?
Okay, great. That's a great question. I'm just going to take a moment just to be in quiet for a sec, see what comes. Yeah, so what I'm about to say isn't always easy, but I'll set it forth as something that I find really helpful is when difficulty arises in relationship, there might be in the midst of that, like it could be in the midst of a heated discussion or heaviness or challenge that may even feel like it's just pulling us in, like it's just the most important thing we've got to talk about or work or, you know, get out of our mouth or, you know, make happen or whatever it is. But in the midst of that, there may also be some sense of the value of the connection with the other person. And sometimes like that doesn't even feel like it's on the radar. But if one could even just open to the possibility that almost like below the surface of what's happening, there's a very precious thing that's presenting, which is the incredible value of the importance of the love and connection with that other person. And if that can be tuned into, it starts to kind of bring into perspective the particular, you know, wave of experience that's hitting. It's kind of like when, you know, the wave is, you know, mounting. If internally we kind of find a sense of like hunkering down into something that's below the wave, then our sense of being that ocean won't feel so tumultuous, and it will, it can give us a kind of an orienting principle, meaning the sacredness of the relationship becomes the most important thing to orient by. even more important than the outcome of the actual dialogue or juncture that you're at in the relationship. And I find that that's a really, really important one, because sometimes conversations can get painful or hurtful, and they can over time really start to damage that connection that's just so, so precious. And so if there's a conscious intention to preserve that loving connection above all else, I think that that's can be really, really helpful.
Yeah, and in fact, I actually, the way I heard the answer to this question and the answer to the previous question about what is the path of union, I heard a similarity there, and you can confirm whether this is true or not. But you had talked about how where your attention goes, you know, energy goes too. And what I just heard you explaining was really to shift your attention. You know, shift your attention from this is so important, I'm so right, you have to see my way, to the importance of the love, the sacredness, you know, the equality, whatever is helpful to shift you, and then your energy would go there too, and then you will be coming from a different place. Does that sound right?
Yes, yes. And there may be a sense of yourself coming from a different place. That's wonderful. It also can feel like just the shift in energy and attention itself starts to shift the dynamic of how charged maybe the more surface conversation is going.
Yeah, thank you. It's a very helpful answer. I appreciate that. Let's see. We do have a question. They didn't put up their hand. They're just typed in the question, so I'll ask it. One person in the room is saying, why do I seem to get very sick after a shift?
I'm just going to get quiet for a minute with that one, too. Let me just see. I'm kind of like just sort of try to call up territory I've been through in myself, I think. You know, there's probably could be many, many answers to this, or many ways that this could be explored. You know, I don't know that a lot of times answers are something that always genuinely speak to something. You know, often an answer can kind of be more it's just much more limited than what's actually occurring. But two themes that just pop forward to me that are common, it seems to be, is that one is that when there's a shift, often there's a greater degree of openness. And so sometimes that openness lends itself to a couple of things. It can lend itself to increased sensitivity and then sometimes overload. It can also, openness can also lend itself to being an arena in which things that have been suppressed or out of balance will respond and in a sense almost rejoice at that openness and want to come to the surface and be included in that openness. So sometimes conditioned patterns will arise, and that may even have a physical effect because those emotional or energetic patterns may kind of have a signature that triggers physiological responses. So that was actually theme one, the openness, even though it was kind of two-parted, the sensitivity and the encouragement or the arena in which a lot might come to surface in the karmically or in the psyche. The second thing, let me just see if I can remember it, besides the openness, is let's see if I can call it back. Well, this wasn't it, but I'll just talk about this. Sometimes when there's an opening, it opens us to a greater sense of wholeness, and parts of ourself that may have kind of felt more divided. So I'm speaking a little bit different now than I'm not speaking so much about suppressed emotions. But let's say like different values that we have, like let's say to be peaceful or to be very vital and alive. You know, one maybe seems more passive, another more active. Like if people feel divided about whether or not spirituality should be A or B, then when they open to a greater sense of wholeness, there might be sort of a whole different process of being reworked in our system, reassembled, so that we can hold those two, you could say paradoxically, or be oriented around both without any sense of division. Now, that's an easy one, like peace and vitality, but it could also be something like, let's say, accepting yourself as you are while still wanting to pursue excellence or, you know, be more refined or skillful. Those may seem like two opposite things, but when one has an opening that opens us to this sort of transmission of wholeness, those two opposite things may seem to seek coming together in harmony. And sometimes when parts of ourself may feel like they carry a sense of division or opposition start to come together in our being, at least in my experience, sometimes that can bring about almost like a kind of a little bit of sense of upheaval that can translate into physical symptoms. So these are just a few ideas. I would probably be able to answer the question more precisely or more effectively for you as an individual if you wanted to, you know, contact me for a private meeting, you know, which I offer regularly.
Yeah, in fact, why don't we just talk about that briefly before, because I always forget details. I call it, you know, the details that maybe other people want to know about, those types of details. So, first of all, you can find Mukti on Adi Ashanti's website, correct? But it seems like there was, I think I just typed Mukti into Yahoo or Mukti into Google and then clicked on something and I went directly to your page on Adi Ashanti's website. But is there something, an address specifically that people should type in to find you?
If they type in Mukti Source, MUKTISOURCE.org, all right, that'll bring up my section of the Adi Ashanti website. If you type in Mukti into things like Google or YouTube or things like that, so many things come up. So sometimes it's easier if you type in Mukti Adya, and then usually I'll come up.
I may have done something like that. Yeah, I may have typed Mukti Adya Shanti because you came right up. It was quite easy. And then talk a little bit about the private sessions that you offer.
Oh, well, for those of you who've been to satsangs, specifically like the way satsangs are given by Adi Ashanti or myself, there's a portion for dialoguing and that can present as a question or as a topic to explore more in depth one-on-one. And that same type of exchange that you might see in the dialogue portion of satsang is the type of exchange that I offer in private by donation to people who contact my scheduler through OpenGate, which is jackie@adyashanti.org, but it's also all on my website, the contact information. You can call her by phone or email her. And those are short meetings, 20 minutes by phone, 30 minutes in person. But when a person comes with a really focused topic or question, it's just amazing what you can cover in that amount of time.
Yeah, I don't talk to people one-on-one, but I used to, and I found it was actually helpful to keep it short, because otherwise sometimes they would go off too far in a direction. To have them focus in on exactly what it was and get to it was very helpful in a very short period of time.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. I just want to point out to everyone, we have about 13 minutes left, I think, if I'm doing math correctly in my head. And again, if you want the opportunity to ask her something or to throw out a topic, this is really a wonderful time. I know that we would probably all love to be with Mukti again, and maybe we'll have that opportunity, but we don't know that for sure. So embrace this opportunity if you would really like to speak with her. We have 13 minutes, and I'd love to hear you speak, and I think she would too. So
yeah, I would. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. All right, let's see if Regina Don Akers has anything else for you. Nothing is coming, so I thought I would check for a hand. I guess this is a very personal question. My question is, do you come to Boulder from time to time as well?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. I think I would love to come and see you. I did get to go see Adya one time. It would be wonderful to come and see you. Also, we usually offer retreats around once a year, and we invite different speakers. So at some point, maybe we'll invite you, and maybe we'll get to have you at one of our own retreats. That would be wonderful if that's possible.
Yeah, just inquire the same way you did for this interview, and we'll see how things come out.
Exactly. And we've already got this year's done, and we might already have next year's done. So it doesn't sound like immediate future, but I like having the possibility there. I've enjoyed very much speaking with you.
Likewise.
One thing that's very nice about you is there's both the sense of, you've heard the saying probably, I can't remember who said it, but something about having your feet on the ground and your head in heaven. And and that's the sense that I get with you, that you have your feet on the ground and your head in heaven. In fact, maybe one thing we could talk about for a moment is just practical things of life. And I don't know what will come to your mind, but, you know, sometimes when people get on this spiritual path and they hear teachings like the world is not real, the world is an illusion, sometimes people say, you aren't even here. There's something that can sometimes happen where the practical things of life either get ignored or they feel guilty for needing to address the practical things of life. Do you have anything to say just about the practical?
I do, yeah. I'll share with you something that if some of you may have seen videos of me or seen me may know, but it's just one of my favorite really practical things, is there are different vantage points and perspectives, as we all know, and but in particularly in spirituality, sometimes they're spoken of as, you know, absolute and relative perspectives, and one thing I find really, really helpful, and can you hear me if I kind of drop this microphone? Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, because I'm going to use my hands.
Okay.
So a really valuable thing is if you take one side of duality and hold it in your right hand and the other side of duality and hold it in your left, there's a way that when you're looking at those two opposites, what is looking can hold them quite easily together. So for an example, like you mentioned that some people say that this is all a dream. And you could put this is a dream in your right hand. And then in your left hand, you could say this is so real. You know, cause sometimes it really feels that way. You know, this is so real. And oh, it's all a dream. And you have each of those perspectives in each hand. And if you get a sense of what is looking down at your palms and really sense the vantage point of that, which is looking at both perspectives or both conclusions, you might get a sense of that, which is looking, has no need to take sides, it has no need to negate your point of view, and that it's very quiet and very simple. And that vantage point is very, very practical when you get stuck. And it doesn't have to be the dream and real example. It could be like, you know, this shouldn't be happening, or I guess it should be happening, you know, because it is, or something like that. And you can have these two things that maybe cause great angst in your system, and you can just look at them and just give the sense of who and what you are that's not landing on either. And it was really quite okay, you know, with not having to decide or know or camp out and dig one's heels in one perspective or another. And this can go for many, many things. You know, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, I should or I shouldn't, or they should or they shouldn't, it could be, we should be devotional, we should be truthful, whatever the opposites are. It can be very, very practical to physically actually create a space where each can be held and also assume the vantage point of that which has ample room for all of it.
That's wonderful. Thank you. That's another thing I think I really enjoy about you. You give very clear examples. In fact, you've answered some questions in a pretty concise way, and yet the amount of clarity and the understanding that at least I received by listening for such a short time, it seems like it should have taken a longer amount of time to receive that much clarity. You're very concise and very clear, so thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like, you know, I've been teaching for a couple decades now, and we'll be celebrating his 20th year next year. And I feel like I'm really lucky in the sense that I've been kind of sitting back listening to so many talks, and I feel like I'm like a living Cliff Notes or something.
Well, the Cliff Notes are good.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I enjoy the living Cliff Notes. We're lucky, I guess, all of us are lucky that you lived him and absorbed it and then are passing it on in your own way, because it is, you know, it is coming through you in a different way, but it's very sweet, and I enjoy it very much.
I'm glad.
Again, does anyone else have anything to ask Mukti before we let her go? I went to an auction last night, and I watched the guy saying, going once, going twice. All right, Mukti, I guess nobody is putting their hand up, and I've kind of run dry, so I don't feel like forcing anything. I guess it's probably time for us to wrap it up. So, again, I want to say thank you very much. I'm actually going to hang up from them, and then I'm going to just come back and have a couple more sentences with you. But if you would like to say goodbye to them, whatever you want to say in closing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I would love to say goodbye and see you later, maybe. And also just to say that may whatever is meant to really land and take root in your being from our time together today, do so with all possible grace. Mm-hmm. And if something arises where you feel like you might need some support, I hope to be available in that capacity for you, either in a more active way, through an appointment or something like that, or just as a presence in the world that really supports the transformation process that each of you are going through.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Mukti, I'll be right back with you. Everyone else, and they're saying thank you, Mukti, for the clarity, and they're sending hearts. And now somebody has their hand up. Larry, did you want to ask Mukti something just before we let her go? Yeah, now a hand comes up. So, Larry, I'll turn the mic over to you. All right, Mukti, so I'm letting go of the mic, and hopefully we'll hear his voice in just a moment. Let's see. Here he comes.
Hey, and Adi Ashanti. I would like to tell you both, with all of my heart, thank you for your amazing contribution to all of humanity for all of time. Thank you for your heart. I love you. Talk to you later.
Okay. All right, and I'm taking the mic back. All right, Mukti, we're back on the mic. So,
but yeah. You're so welcome.
Yeah, that was a very sweet way to end it for all of us. I think he spoke for all of us, so that was very sweet. I appreciate that. All right, everyone, I'm going to release the mic and turn it back over to Lynn. And I'll see you guys. I'll be back in 33 minutes for today's daily contemplation. All right, bye-bye.